sends a group of spies into the promised land to scout out the territory. The spies bring back a variety of reports, but the most widely believed, and by the way, the most groundless, is that there are great armies, armies of giants, waiting to strike Israel down should they so much as attempt to enter the land. It's bad reporting, it's fear-mongering, it's propaganda. As far as I can tell, it's the first recorded example of cable television, and it works perfectly. The people are terrified. They say, surely we cannot defeat such armies, even with God on our side. It would have been better off had we never left Egypt. Let's go back. Back to Pharaoh, back to slavery, which is exactly what we pick up today. God comes down into the tent to Moses, furious that the people are losing their faith. How long will they despise me, he asks. I will send pestilence against them. I will cut them off. The promises we made, done, finished, forget it. You want to be on your own? Fine. We'll see how that goes. But Moses argues back. In some way, it's a prayer. This summer at PCCH, we are preaching through what Walter Brueggemann calls the great prayers of the Old Testament. And after last week's journey with Abraham, this is our second stop, a kind of case study for intercessory prayer. But honestly, it could just as easily be a case study at a business seminar for negotiation tactics. Tactic number one, appeal to vanity. Moses says, God, you swore you'd get us into the promised land. It's actually a matter of public record. And if you give up on us, and particularly if you send pestilence against us, if you don't mind me saying, God, I think it might make you look weak. The other nations are watching. You don't want to look weak in front of the other nations, do you? Tactic number two, use their own words against them. Here, Moses brings out the big guns. He goes straight to the language of the contract, straight to the law given in Exodus 34. So now, let me see if I've got this right. Slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love, forgiving iniquities. Frankly, I don't see a lot of room in here for pestilence. But we do have a caveat. It says that you will not go around just forgiving any old thing. It says, and here I'm just going to quote, you will visit the iniquity of the parents on the children to the third and fourth generation. Interesting. So let me make a counterproposal then, God. You let us into the promised land as previously scheduled, and maybe we just pick up this whole judgment thing at a later date. Say, 3 or 4 generations down the road. You can see what caught my eye. The things we do to children. So, why? What kind of God punishes children for the sins of their parents? It's not right. It's not fair. I don't think we really believe it. If we did, what would we say at baptism? See that this child is called the child of God, but it's also the child of Urbanalis over there, so good luck. To punish the children for sins of the parents? This isn't what we say. And what's more, in this story, it's not even what God does. After the negotiations are over, God informs Moses that it will instead be the current generation that will pay their own debt, that will not reach the promised land, 40 years of wandering as penitents for their unbelief. The punishment Moses has tried to kick down the road lands squarely at his own feet, not at the feet of generations yet to be born. So I'm in preaching 101. Find the problem in the text. Find that moment that springs the question you can run with. And friends, it is very tempting to stand here today and tell you that the problem in this text is that God claims to punish children for the sins of their parents. Then we could play the game of getting God off the hook. I can see the sermon laid out before me. I point out that the Old Testament is inconsistent on this very point. But in Deuteronomy, God claims precisely the opposite, that we're clearly standing on an issue of some controversy for ancient Israel. I could drown it out with so many revelations of God's grace. I can assure you that The God we worship, the God revealed in Jesus Christ, is not a vengeful and grudge-holding God if it closes with a good old-fashioned hallelujah. But that's not the problem in this text. God's words, yes, but in quotes. In this context, it's Moses who makes the demand. Moses who tries to pass off the debts of his generation onto generations to come. So the problem in this text is not that God punishes children for the sins of their parents. That's not what God does. That's what we do. It's the thing we do to children. And in this text, we are the problem. So if you'll forgive the cliche, what kind of world do we leave to the next generation? What will be their inheritance? You know the issues. I know you've read the headlines. Children born today inherit a world teetering on the brink of environmental, economic, political collapse. This is the part of the sermon where I just open up the newspaper. Ecosystems are failing. Time magazine reports this week that global carbon is wreaking havoc upon the oceans in ways far more devastating than we had previously imagined. If the current trajectory of damages continues, they say a new extinction event is inevitable. Meanwhile, on NPR, the news is that while scientific consensus on climate change has moved well past the margin of error, the American public is actually less likely to believe it than we were 5 years ago, as if disbelieving it would somehow make it go away. Or, for a change of subject, you could read in The Guardian this week about that the world's richest people have actually swollen in population since the beginning of the global recession. This group here, anyone with over a bare $1 million in free assets, is also richer than ever, accounting for more than $40 trillion in a world economy currently, instead banking its hopes on this noble self-sacrifice of the Greek working class in order to stave off another meltdown. Itself a far likelier bet, it would seem, than one on reasoned congressional discourse about the debt ceiling. It's hard not to imagine these bank accounts fed, however circuitously, off the backs of the global poor, with the lives of young men and women lost on the battlefield, at the cost of so many silenced dissident voices, with the hopes and dreams of the next generation. I kid you not, at the moment I wrote those lines, a headline popped up on my screen: don't underestimate the possibility of catastrophe. What kind of inheritance do we leave? Obviously, there's an elephant in the room. We are not all one generation, and I may look as much like a child to some of you as I seem a parent to others. I admit to seeing the part of the world I have inherited with some dose of the young man's anger, the anger of Ezekiel in exile. The parents have eaten sour grapes, and the children's teeth are on edge. But the truth is that in every moment we are all, each of us, camped with Moses and the Israelites, lost in the fog of the wilderness, straining to see into the promised land. And we will never be the ones to pay the price for our biggest failures. How, then, will this generation Choi is not a well-rounded character, but the town could count on her alarmism to punctuate any crisis with the wailing of, "Won't somebody please think of the children?" It's easier to find ironic distance and throw up our hands. And besides, the problems are so big and we are so scattered. Environmental degradation is a massive, many-sided problem, the result of centuries of collective ignorance, willful and otherwise, of the consequences of modernity. What is one guy to do? Of course, there's nothing wrong with cutting up your plastic six-pack holder so as not to kill the sea turtle. Please do, it's better than the alternative. But at their core, the sins we pass on are interconnected global crises that cannot be fixed with a series of "here's how you can help" after-school specials. We make individual choices the best way we can. They're the only choices we know how to make. But we make them with the haunting fear that there's only so much one person can do. Which is again my question to Moses. Why? You're in a unique position. You have the ability to make an individual decision that will affect the collective fate of an entire nation. And frankly, all the guy has to do is stop talking. Just pull back the part about mercy and forgiveness and leave off the part about punishing future generations. It's easy enough. The psalmist does exactly this when he quotes the same passage. "You were negotiating so well. You had God on the ropes. You've already won. Ask for your heart's desire. Ask for the moon and the stars. Why put it on the children? Why take it down the road? Selfishness, political cowardice. Are you in bed with special interests? Do the judgment lobbyists have you in their pocket? What's the problem?" Actually, for Moses, there was probably some morbid comfort in reminding God to visit the sins of his generation onto his descendants. In the wilderness, Israel is living day by day, nearly slaughtered at the edge of the Red Sea, nearly starved until the manna descended. The covenant so freshly made at Sinai seems inadequate to the threats of the present moment, the threats of imminent extinction. For Moses, the promise of God visiting sins upon future generations is a promise that future generations will exist. Listen to the urgency of the negotiation. If you kill all these people all at one time, Moses is stalling. He's buying time the only way he knows how, by holding God to a covenant guarantee of survival. A covenant promise wrapped as it is in a cloak of judgment and vindication. It's a guarantee that God's covenantal promise holds even when Israel's faithfulness falters, even when God's temper flares, even with extinction itself on the line. And at the end of the day, it's not a promise about forgiveness or judgment or mercy. It's a promise of presence, of relationship, a promise that God will be with them to as many generations as can be counted. It's a promise made to Abraham. It's a promise ratified at Sinai. But as Christians, we embrace it first and foremost as a promise embodied on the cross, in the willing self-sacrifice of Jesus Christ. If you kill this people all at one time, it's actually kind of like a Hebrew idiom. Quite literally, it says, if you kill this nation like it was just one guy, like it was just a man, just one guy who couldn't possibly make a difference. A coincidence of language, to be sure, but in equal measure, a prophecy of the one man whose life and death ensured the inheritance of that promise to each and every coming generation, to the third, to the fourth, to the thousandth, a promise not just of mercy, but of passion. A promise that, try as we might, our sins are finally borne not by our own sons and daughters, but rather by mystery of his will as a plan for the fullness of time to gather up all things in him, things in heaven and things on earth. This is the pledge of our inheritance toward redemption as God's own people. Our children will inherit the world coming apart at the seams, but they will also inherit the covenant of the grace of God, which is from everlasting to everlasting. So in our final moments, I want you to put in your mind's eye the child you have loved, a friend, a family member, your own. I want you to gaze together into the world this child will inherit. 10, 20, 50 years. The sins we pay forward, the work we leave undone. Yes, there is propaganda. Yes, there is fear-mongering. But there are also real problems, real crises. Don't underestimate the possibility of catastrophe. None of us should in any way be convinced that we can leave to our children a better world than the one we found, not without courage, not without sacrifice, not without imagination of an altogether new caliber. You know, Mrs. Lovejoy is right. Somebody does have to think about the children. And it is past time for us to beg each other for a general reckoning of accounts for the sake of that child, of their children, to the third, fourth, thousandth generation. But know this as well. The God of the wilderness, the God of the promised land, the God who suffers for us on the cross and triumphs over even the grave, that God has the same child in his mind's eye. That God sees with a perfect parent's eyes, with kindness, with mercy, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love, and bearing for the generations to come an inheritance of